This episode of Walter Edgar's Journal is an encore of a previously broadcast program.
Welcome to Walter Edgar's Journal. With me in the Scanner studio today are Betsy Teeter, who is the guiding spirit of Hub City Press in Spartanburg, and James McTeer, who is this year's winner of the first novel award in South Carolina. And so, James and Betsy, welcome to the Journal.
Oh, it's terrific to be here. Thank you for inviting us.
Thank you for having us.
Betsy, let's talk a little bit about Hub City. You've been going now for 2 decades.
Who would have thought it?
I know. And let's talk about how it came about. And although you're based in Spartanburg, you obviously reach out to writers all across the state.
And beyond, all across the South now. Hub City started 20 years ago in a new coffee shop on Morgan Square in downtown Spartanburg when three writers met each other there and decided that we wanted to put writers to work for Spartanburg. Spartanburg was in pretty much a depressed condition at that point and had been very casual with its history. So we modeled ourselves after the Federal Writers Project, which, of course, was when FDR put 6,000 writers to work for America during the Great Depression. And so we put out a book called Hub City Anthology, and that's all we were going to do until the response from Spartanburg was so great. The book sales were enormous. The community came out to our event, and suddenly we had a little pot of money, and we said, let's keep going. That was the beginning.
And so how many titles have you published in the last 20 years?
James McTeer's book, Minnow, is our 70th book. And we've, during that time, we've put something like 700 writers in books. So we've published as many as 700 writers. And we're rolling now with seven books a year. And that's the Hub City of 2015.
I mean, Betsy, that's given the publishing business today, that's just really pretty incredible.
It is remarkable. And in the early years, we leaned on our own community, which was incredibly supportive, both with charitable contributions and buying these books we were putting out. In the early years, we began doing books about the history and the culture of Spartanburg. We did a book about the musical history of the community. It was called Hub City Music Makers. We did a book about peach farming, the World War II camps, and the World War I camps, Camp Wadsworth, Camp Croft. We also did a book about the textiles in Spartanburg. And so those were years when we were working very hard, putting out a lot of books, making a little bit of money.
And actually, you earlier mentioned that you modeled yourself on the WPA Writers Project. That, with those books about Spartanburg, that's exactly what you were doing.
That's what we were doing. We were putting writers to work, capturing the history and the culture of Spartanburg. And then as we hit our second decade, we began branching out statewide. We had a great partnership with the South Carolina Arts Commission. We published books of poetry and short stories across the state. And then that had been successful, and now we're now publishing of Southeastern authors. We've got authors now in Richmond and Wilmington, North Carolina, Charlottesville. We have a couple of Atlanta authors next year. So as we've learned what we're doing, Hub City continues to grow and spread out across the Southeast.
Well, that's really a heartening story, particularly given the publishing business today. And I mean it with all affection, with a regional publisher.
It is not easy to be a publisher these days. And in fact, we are one of the few literary publishers in the Southeast right now. We've had great support from the Arts Commission, and we've had great support from our own community. And we work very hard. Yeah.
Well, James McTeer II, how did you get involved with Hub City? You're here in Columbia. You grew up in Beaufort. You're here in Columbia now. How'd you get involved with Hub City?
Right. Well, I've been writing my whole life. And as I got older, I had some complete manuscripts, and I'm shopping them around from different agents and different editors from time to time, mostly agents, just looking to get a foot in that door to get my book out there. And like you said, the publishing industry is in tumultuous times right now, and it's a tough egg to crack. So as I was finishing Minnow, which was my first sort of specifically Southern novel, where I was really trying to capture that Southern feel, I started looking around at presses in South Carolina. And I knew a few by name already, but I had actually never heard of Hub City and just found them on the internet and thought they had a real slick-looking outfit, good-looking website, beautiful books. I was really looking at the books they were putting out, what was the content, and also how did they look, how did they appear, you know, were they something that I would want to buy? And found Hub City and was finishing up Minnow. Thought that I might submit it during one of their query windows, one of their windows for submission, but the contest was opening up in a couple months, so I thought, let me just try the contest first.
So you tried the first novel contest.
That's right.
And you won. You got the brass ring the very first time around.
He did. I remember Mike Curtis read his manuscript in the opening round, and Mike Curtis, of course, is the fiction editor of The Atlantic, who lives up in Spartanburg. And Mike sent it on up to our other judge, who is Ben Fountain. And Ben, of course, won the National Book Critics Circle Award for Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk. And Ben has some roots in South Carolina, and he's now in Texas. And Ben picked this novel and wrote me an email and said, "You got no idea what you have here. This is a phenomenal book." And so we danced around the office, and I read it that night. It's the kind of book that you read at one sitting because it moves so fast. And so we've been very excited about it ever since. It's gotten tremendous reviews. It's gotten a starred review in Library Journal, a starred review in Kirkus. And James managed to sell through his first printing in about 12 days. So we're waiting for that second printing now to come out.
Okay. May I ask how large the first printing was?
The first printing was 3,000 books.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's great.
I think that's pretty good.
And it's very good.
Not bad for a first-timer.
Yeah. And James, you said you've been writing all your life. You act as if you're old. I think you're like, I think you must be 21 or 22. Where did you? I know you grew up in Beaufort in a family of storytellers. Where did you go to college?
I attended USCB, the satellite campus down there, for my undergrad.
Okay.
It was just the right thing for me to do to stay in Beaufort at that time. Had sort of an interesting end to my public school career, and it was nice to phase into USCB down there. And got to work with some great professors who were there in a real small town sort of setting. So that's where I got my undergrad in English.
Was that when the campus was still downtown, or had it moved out?
I mostly went downtown, and in fact, it was we were just cracking into the four-year university world there. I sort of was part of lobbying to get a four-year English degree down there.
Okay. But, of course, the main campus now is at Sun City.
Right, so. Mostly down in Bluffton.
Yeah, yeah. So talk about growing up in Beaufort. You knew all about your grandfather, who was a legend in South Carolina history, the White Witch Doctor. The sheriff. Some folks out there might not know much about Sheriff McTeer. So let's talk a little bit about him and how he and your other storytelling kinfolk, shaped your world.
Right. Well, I was lucky to grow up in Beaufort. I always say that. What a place to grow up in, the natural world, the history there, the culture there, the food there. Maybe not so much for a kid to do there sometimes, but a fun town to live in. And like you said, just growing up, learning the legends of my grandfather, learning his stories and his lore, and some other folks in my family. My great-grandmother on my mom's side was Clotilde Martin, and she did some writing for the state, too. So storytelling was in the blood, and hearing all these stories of writers in my family growing up did inspire me to want to write.
And somewhere, was it at your grandmother's, there was a storeroom or storehouse that was full of artifacts related to voodoo, if you will, native religions.
Yeah, you might be referring to the shed. That when my grandfather died, a lot of his voodoo talismans and artifacts and things that had been sent in wound up in a shed in Coffins Point and just sort of stayed out there collecting dust. And then when my grandmother passed away, it was time to sort of figure out what to do with all those things. So we got to go out there and open these doors, and there were, you know, paintings and sculptures and mounted boar heads and artifacts from Africa and mandrake roots and all these different things that we sort of got to dig into and sort out as a family and decide this needed to stay, this needed to go, you know, we could keep this, we should toss that, you know.
So did you keep anything personally?
Oh, yeah, I've got some artifacts that have traveled with me now. You know, obviously my dad kept a lot, and then some was parceled out to me or my sisters or my brother. But I've got some things at the house that were in his original altar, you might say.
Do you practice?
No.
Okay. Anybody else in your family practice?
You know, if someone were to need something to take with them on a long journey of adventure to keep them safe and to guide them, you might be able to procure that in my family.
Okay. All right. Let's move on to writing the novel. You said you've been writing for a while.
I've been writing since I could hold a pen in my hand, just little scribbling little stories and things like that. And as you just get older, you begin to imitate books you like and have some sort of derivative stories. And then eventually you start to create your own stories and hopefully emerge into where I am now, just writing whole books.
So what's the genesis of Minnow?
Well, it started as just a sentence in a composition notebook that I had written down, just the idea of writing a story sort of framed by the geography of the Barrier Islands. So a chain story, episodic in nature, where you would go from island to island and sort of experience different adventures and stories along the way. That was the very smallest seed. And from there, I just started to kind of roll it around in my mind and say, well, who are the characters going to be? Who's going to go on this journey? What sort of adventures will he have? And what will the outcome be? What's the dilemma? What's the problem? What's the arc? How are we going to change? But it all started with that one idea of Barrier Island sort of structure.
And any reason you chose to set it in the 1890s?
An interesting period where, you know, you've always had a mix of cultures in Beaufort, no matter, you know, going way back or even right now to this very day. But just, you know, turn of the century there was a time when you hadn't stepped really into the modern era yet. I feel, you know, for instance, my granddad wouldn't have even been born yet at that time. So just a good period where you got the old and the new mixing. And there was a historic event, a storm that sort of inspired some parts of the book.
Yeah, the Great Hurricane of
1893, the tide of death.
Yeah, and you set most of the novel really in Black Beaufort, in the Black community. Mm-hmm. Personal experiences with that?
Well, growing up in Beaufort, and I think I talked about this at the book festival a little bit, I feel I had a little different experience with race because the history of integration in Beaufort and the history of supporting the Black population in a way that it might not have been supported in other places in the South and even in other places in South Carolina. So growing up as a kid, my best friends were African Americans. I went to school and it was a very balanced population. I went to school out on the islands, in fact. So my experience with race, I think, is much different than someone who might have grown up in a different part of South Carolina even. So it was important for me to show that Minnow could move through this world, the Black world of the islands, as you put it, move through it as a child and experience it differently than an adult would have.
Minnow is what, 10, 11?
Yeah, I never really nail it down in the novel. You can do a little...
He doesn't seem to be a teenager. That's
right,
what,
no.
And I think that's probably important.
Right.
He's not a toddler, but I mean, he's old enough to be, by 10, I guess we all could go out and feel like we could do things on our own.
Right. I thought about that. When do we feel like we can go out and make decisions and sort of take control of our own lives, even if maybe we some of the decisions we're making aren't really making that much change in our lives, but we feel that we can.
And so, Betsy, how did you said you sat down and read this novel in one sitting?
Well, to me, this book was a mix of a book like Life of Pi, a little bit of Indiana Jones, a little bit of Pat Conroy's Water is Wide, and then Heart of Darkness, because the last, I guess, 20% of that book is very dark. And you wouldn't expect that as you begin with Minnow on his sweet journey. So it had a little bit of everything, including some magical realism. And I love books that have magical realism. So that's what we had. And it's interesting to talk to hear James talk about his book. We called in an editor, the toughest editor I've got up there. And she loved the book as well. She tried to get him to... Minnow addresses the root doctors as sir or ma'am in the book, and she said, well, in that era, no white person would address an African-American with sir or ma'am, but James said, yes, they would. My character would, and yes, I would have as a child. That was an interesting point we got to with this book. Yeah.
That is something that I, too, noticed when I figured it was set in the 1890s. Now, you as a young man may have, but you as author said, that's what I want, and that's fine. Maybe.
That's who Minnow was, I think. If you come to know Minnow in this book, that's who Minnow was.
Right, and it was important. I picked a childlike narrator knowing that it wouldn't be your average child. Minnow is not a normal 10-year-old. Like you said, some of us at 10 may feel like we can go out and sort of conquer the world, but Minnow's a special child, and I took a little inspiration from As I Lay Dying on that. There's a character named Darl who narrates portions of the book, and he's a very poetic narrator. He sees the world sort of in a different way, not just as a clever, nice, smart child, but he's got a different perspective that maybe even some of us don't even get as adults. So I looked at Minnow as a narrator who could tell us this story through childlike eyes, but also have a perspective that was just a little different, just a little different angle.
He's very comfortable with the natural world, mm-hmm. the gators or what have you, and the jungle-like growth, which it really is on the islands. And he's also very comfortable with the supernatural. He grew up with it, and we've had many people on the show over the years who are familiar with the Lowcountry, and they say there's just something there, and you have to understand that. You have to believe it.
Yeah, how surprised would you be to be a Minnow walking out and to see a haint or a light or something like that? I grew up with it, like you said. You know, you go seeking the lands and light. You go seeking these ghosts and these legends and these haunted places. So to me, I think if I was walking through the swamps and saw a plat eye, I don't know if I would be that surprised either.
Okay, but then the plat eye takes many shapes.
Oh, it does. Yeah, and you never know what shape that may be and or whether you get any hints as to what it is.
I can't remember. Does Minnow go off with a sulfur match behind his ear?
No, he does not have a match behind his ear. He carries a few talismans, though.
Okay. And we might explain to our listeners what the sulfur match is supposed to do. That's to keep the plat eye away.
That's a protective thing. Yeah, matches and sulfur, that'll show up a lot in your voodoo lore, even if it's just sulfur powder or something you can sprinkle around to protect yourself.
Okay. Well, let's get into the novel and talk about how it develops. Won't give away the conclusion, but let's kind of walk our listeners through. And both of you, you as author and Betsy as reader, kind of walk us through. Let's set the scene and take off.
Well, the book begins very innocently. There's a boy, his father's lying in a bed. His father's wasting away from some mysterious illness. His mother is very concerned. His mother says, we need some medicine. Here's a little bit of money. Go to the pharmacy in downtown Newfort, not Beaufort, but Newfort. And so Minnow tootles off down the dirt street of Beaufort and has an encounter with a very ornery pharmacist. And take it from there, James.
Right. And it was important for me that first part. Like you said, he tootles off. It's sort of a child's journey, a child's errand that day to begin with. And that was important to start with that. But then after you meet the pharmacist, he can't provide the medicine that Minnow needs. So he refers him to another practitioner, a root worker in Port Royal. So
a root worker, that's the term, not witch doctor, it's a root.
Right, and there's some blurriness there. You know, there's no sort of strict rules about it, but I would see Dr. Crow as being more of a root worker. He's in town, he's sort of practicing there.
Positive, he's a healer.
Well, a root worker could go either way.
Oh, okay. Minnow, and where does he get his name?
That was just a choice I made pretty early on. I didn't want to give him a normal sort of name, a normal street name, if you will. I was looking for something kind of mythical, something legendary to give that fairy tale aspect to it.
But his mother calls him Minnow.
Right, yeah. Presumably we know no other name for him.
Yeah. I mean, some people might think it's strange. In my era growing up 60 years ago, sometimes kids were called tadpole.
Mm-hmm. Pollywog.
Right. Yeah.
Pollywog.
Yeah. So. Yeah.
Well, a minnow is small, it's diminutive, and it's also a bait fish. So,
interestingly, when this book won the contest, it was called Grave Dust from Islands Far because, of course, the Dr. Crow sends him to find the dust from the grave of Sorry George. And we thought that title was a little clunky and thought that Minnow was a better title for sales, so the book became Minnow. And of course, it's got a beautiful cover on it when you get it. We hired an artist that we found in the south of England to draw this cover of Minnow and the little dog. And you can see the hurricane beginning to blow in. You've got palmetto trees there that are beginning to blend. And there's a hint of a big old alligator there.
So Minnow goes to see George.
Well, Dr. Crow's first.
Dr. Crow first.
Right. and gets this, Dr. Crow tells him, well, I don't have the medicine, but I can get it for you. But, you know, tit for tat, you're going to have to do something for me. And there's where Minnow gets his real quest. You know, the boy's errand is over at that point. The quest is now to go get goofer dust, which is what we call grave dust or dirt from a grave.
And from a very celebrated root doctor.
Right. Sorry, George's grave. Sorry, George was an infamous root doctor, did terrible things, but that's what makes him so powerful and so sought after.
He, at one time, he killed 50 people?
52 men, actually, to be precise. 52 men died from a fever he spread. So there's a root doctor who was working the dark magic.
Okay. But how does he get there? How does he find Sorry George's grave?
Right. Well, that's the whole story there. I knew, like I said, I sat down with that structure and looked at it. And once I knew that he was going to get goofer dust, I said, now I can just fill it up with any episode or adventure I want along the way. So I just sort of started outlining and thinking about what are all the things a boy needs to run into to have an exciting time out to the islands.
He has more than an exciting time because he doesn't just have to deal with, I would call it the supernatural world, but you know, he runs into people who live on the various islands. And you might explain, James, that we're not just talking about one island. He's going to a whole series of islands, some of which are not very large.
Right. I was looking to demonstrate in the book, some islands are a sand dune with some grass on top of it. Some islands are so big that you can have a whole town on them. And it was important for me, once we got out there, that you almost got mixed up. He crosses so many creeks and rivers that you don't really know where he is. And there had been some suggestion early on about doing a map. And I think that got shot down pretty quick because it's just one, you don't want to map it out. You don't want to say, okay, here's the path Minnow took. It was sort of
because it's so dreamlike.
Yeah,
it's a product of your imagination. Yeah.
It needed to be a nebulous sort of dreamlike journey across these islands. And anyone who's been even to modern Beaufort, you know, you can drive around a little bit and wind up over causeways and creeks and little bridges and big bridges and all sorts of things.
That brings me to a question. Is this a real venture or is this all a dream?
Oh, it's a good question. I would lean toward real adventure. I think Minnow does take this trip and has a coming-of-age sort of journey out there. But capturing that dreamlike state was really important. I feel like you can sort of boil down to the essence of history and culture by using some of that magic realism and some of that looking at things through a surreal lens.
And yet this book ends up in a nightmare scenario, I think. You know, I'm not going to give a whole lot away here, but it reminded me of a scene from Cormac McCarthy's The Road. It's that dark. And it also reminded me of a Confederate battlefield. I remember reading that scene at the end going, this reminds me of a Confederate battlefield. So it's a very dark book at the end.
That darkness is created by the hurricane.
It is. Yes, and James knows the history of the hurricane that he wove into this book.
The hurricane of 1893 was probably one of the greatest storms ever to hit the United States. They didn't rate them, but it did. It literally wiped out the populations of the sea islands. On places like Edisto, for example, 10 feet of water covered the island, and people couldn't grow crops for years because the soil had been soured. We had a governor who didn't want any aid given to the distressed folks. They don't know literally how many thousands of people died in that storm because many of them were on the islands, and a lot of those small islands, some of those islands disappeared.
Yeah.
I mean,
James has a very riveting scene, if you've read the book, with Minnow up a tree with a woman that he's met and his dog. We haven't talked much about Minnow's dog. But as he tries to not blow away up in that tree, that's the scene that James read at the South Carolina Book Festival. And it brings a lot of response from an audience.
Right. And this idea of the island being underwater was really important. One of the descriptions you'll hear of the storm of 1893 was that it was like a second tide. The tide was high that day, but then when you went out and looked again, it had not gone down. It had actually risen another tide. And that's even inland and, you know, looking into Beaufort. So,
you mentioned the dog, Betsy, and the dog is a major figure. And I asked you, and again, I won't tell how it ends, but is it really a dog or is it a plaid eye?
That's a great question. There's some hints along the way. Depending on how much you know about plaid eyes and these sort of things, you might be able to pick up some extra clues. But I did leave it ambiguous. I want you to sort of think about it. And there are some times when the relationship with the dog changes. You know, he meets the dog in one sort of circumstances and sort of interacts with it in one way. And then after the hurricane, if you read real careful, things change after that.
Mm-hmm. But he is always on the lookout for that. Once he and the dog meet up, he is as concerned about the dog as he is about his quest.
Right. The dog becomes part of the quest and his traveling partner. And there are times when the dog puts itself in danger, I think, to save Minnow, and Minnow understands, like, I have to take advantage of this. I can't mourn for the dog at this very moment. Maybe I will later, but I have to take advantage of what the dog has given me.
And then you get into one of the last stages before the storm on one of the islands. He basically becomes involved in a root ceremony, mm-hmm. a voodoo ceremony, whatever you want to call it, where drumming is very important. Of course, we know now, historically, drums are a very important part of the African-American culture, particularly the Gullah culture. And they give him something to drink. And that's, again, where you begin to wonder, is it real or is it a dream? But he does get dirt.
In the end.
In the end.
But that's not the end.
Yeah. No, that's not the end.
Sometimes getting what you went out for is just the beginning.
Yeah. At one point, I think you brought in the gray man. You talk about seeing his father walking the beach. And that, when I saw that, I said, okay, there's got to be a storm coming. I mean, that's...
That's the Pauly's Island gray man.
The Pauly's
Very
Island.
Very much a reference there, yeah.
But it's interesting that it was his father that he, or the shade of his father mm-hmm. that he saw walking the beach. For some of our listeners might not realize it, if you see this figure walking the beach at Pauly's Island called the gray man, that is a sure indication that there is a severe storm headed that way.
Exactly.
I tried to tie in a lot of legends and things like that. Before I wrote Minnow, I sat down with just a stack of local history books and not trying to get the history perfect, but just trying to get all the stories and all this inspiration. So, yeah. You know, the gray man, all sorts of different ghost stories and legends wrapped up in there.
Yeah. Folks, we have to pause for a moment to let our listeners know that this is Walter Edgar's Journal, and I'm talking with Betsy Teeter of Hub City Press and James E. McTeer II, who is the winner of the first novel prize. Betsy, let's go back to Hub City, and you are the spark plug behind it, but it's not a one-person show.
It is not. The man I'm now married to is John Lane, poet, fiction writer, essayist, and John was the vision guy behind Hub City. We also had our friend Gary Henderson involved in the early days. Gary was a journalist. And so the first years of Hub City, we functioned out of my house. I had a fax machine beside my bed, and the orders would come in at night, and worked on the dining room table. And today, we have a staff of 6 people. We also run the independent bookstore in Spartanburg, right downtown on the square. We run a residency program where we bring a fabulous fiction writer or poet or essayist from somewhere else in the country to live in Spartanburg and work with us for a period of time.
Now, who are some of the folks you've had?
Well, you wouldn't recognize their names. Hub City is really about emerging writers and debut authors. You'll see almost every novel that we have published has been a debut novel. So we're sort of hunting around for some writers who are young in their career but beginning to get published. And they come in and, for instance, this summer we have a writer coming to us from Syracuse, New York. Her name is Okweke Emeke, and she's a fiction writer studying with George Saunders and Mary Carr. So she will come in and do workshops in our community and work in the bookstore and help with the press. This year we've had a young poet from Minneapolis named Casey Patrick with us. So this is a program that's sort of been vital to the lifeblood of Hub City. It brings in new ideas and mixes it up. 3 times a year, we get a new employee coming in who can also work in our community. But we, I've got 2 MFA creative writers on my staff now that are making books and marketing books. And we have this fabulous independent bookstore right in the center of the city, which I think has had a lot to do with the revitalization of that part of the city.
And when you bring in these guest artists, you have workshops with young writers, is that correct?
We do. We do. They visit schools. They visit colleges. They have workshops with in the community where we bring people, where they come to the bookshop or to the Chapman Center and do workshops. And they just bring their own ideas with them, and we get something different every time.
James, had you attended a workshop?
I had not. I had not been to Spartanburg much, really, in my life until I was published by Hub City Press.
Oh, okay.
And now I'm a huge fan. The 20th anniversary party they had there was amazing. The street was closed. We had everything from belly dancers to Shakespeare soliloquies. So that was a great weekend.
So are you one of those Lowcountry boys who, you know, once you get above Columbia, you begin to get a nosebleed and you figure you have to head back to the coast?
I do. I dry out. It's bad. I've luckily got Lake Murray to dip myself in, which helps a little bit. But I go back to Beaufort probably two or three times a month, believe it or not, to soak in the Pluff mud.
Okay. So how long have you been in Columbia?
4 years now.
And you're a school librarian?
A school librarian, elementary school librarian.
Actually, they still call you a librarian, not a media center?
I'm a media specialist in a media center, but I also cherish the word library and librarian.
Okay.
So I'm not one of those who shuns the term.
So you still have books in your media center?
I live amongst the books. I believe there are media centers in my district that are very low on books, and it's mostly electronic sort of fashion, but I am a book library.
What's fun about finding pulling someone from obscurity like James is we know that in future years, he will be a big part of Hub City. For instance, Ray McManus from down here in Columbia. We published his book, Punch, a collection of poetry, last fall. This book was just received the Gold Ippy Award as the best book of poetry by an independent press in North America last year.
Wow.
That is a big deal. And Ray will teach at our writers' conference this summer, and he's a vital part of Hub City now. So between the bookstore, the residency, the writers' workshop in the summer, and the press, we found a way to involve just about every writer we could get our hands on.
Well, I noticed you said the judges both had one connection with The Atlantic, great old American literary magazine, and the other one also was in the literary world in New York, but both had South Carolina roots.
South Carolina roots. And the first novel prize now, we've gone through four winners. The first one was a student at the MFA program in Columbia. His name was Brian Ray. Matt Matthews won for Mercy Creek, and Matt's up in Greenville. Susan Tacolvi won for In the Garden of Stone, which is a book about Sicilians in the West Virginia coal mines. Susan's from Spartanburg, and now James, who is sort of Columbia and Beaufort. So we've managed to get all the way across the state and are looking forward to the contest being back open in January, where you will send us your manuscript.
Well, let me ask you this. They must be South Carolinians to compete for them.
You have to have lived in South Carolina. I think it's two consecutive years at the time you submit. Okay. So that does mean that you might have come here, mm-hmm. and you cannot have published another novel. Now, we find a lot of people are throwing their books up on Kindle these days, and that disqualifies you. So if you're listening to the Walter Edgar Show and you've got a go to the webpage of the South Carolina Arts Commission and read about this first novel prize. It's the only prize of its kind in the country, the only prize that is co-sponsored by an arts commission in the country.
How many submissions do you get?
I think we had about 50 this year. We've had years where it went to 70 and years that it went down to about 40, but that's a good manageable number.
And you read everyone?
We have a group of first-tier judges that get about eight books. Those guys read those eight books, and then we narrow it down to about six novels. I think our judges have included Joe Humphreys, Brett Lott, Percival Everett, and now Ben Fountain. Mm-hmm. We send six novels to the judge and come out with a winner.
Okay.
That's how it works, and it's a great contest, and we have thoroughly enjoyed working with each of these writers that win. Hub City generally is publishing just one novel a year. We may toy with two going forward, but we keep that number low because we are very involved in marketing the book and setting up author tours and interviews. And it is important to Hub City that if we publish a book, we are completely behind it and we have plenty of time to market it and give it the exposure it needs. That's the model at Hub City. We don't throw out lots of books and hope one of them sticks. Like most publishers, we find the one that we love, and we found the one for 2016, and we throw everything behind it.
All right. Well, what have you got planned for James? We know he just finished being at the book festival. So what's his tour like for the next 6 months?
Well, James has he's done Columbia. He's done Beaufort. He's got Greenville in the future. This summer, he's going to have a baby. So we're going to have a little bit of an interruption in the book tour, but he's doing a lot of book clubs in Beaufort. He's going to be at the Southern Festival of the Book in Nashville come fall. We're going to try to get him to almost every city in South Carolina with a bookstore. And the state library is going to be involved in hooking him up with some libraries around the state. So he will see a lot of South Carolina and beyond on his book tour, which should take him on into the fall. In fact, we booked some things in 2016, the Sun City retirement community is having him down in 2016.
It's on the calendar.
Are you a nonprofit? Is Hub City a nonprofit?
Hub City is a nonprofit organization. We've had our nonprofit status since about 2000. We are the only nonprofit literary arts organization in the country that both has a press and an independent bookstore. So we are an unusual type of organization that has just sort of evolved with what our community needs. We're an organization now, like I said, with six people. Along the way, we started a second organization called Hubbub, which is now a freestanding arts organization in Spartanburg. And we've done everything from put public sculpture in Spartanburg to build parks to festivals. Along the way, we've been a lot of different things to our community. And now we're really focused on becoming the premier literary publisher in the Southeast.
James, when you told him he won, was it a telephone call, an email, or the knock on the door, like you have won Publisher's Clearinghouse?
Well, I will tell you that our great partner is Sarah June Goldstein, who has been head of literary arts at the South Carolina Arts Commission for years. Mm-hmm. And the first novel prize is Sarah June's baby. So Sarah June is always excited about making that call, and she lets me be on speakerphone. But
right. I got an email first that said, James, we need to talk about your book in regard to the contest. You know, can we get in touch with you? And I was like, okay, what have I done wrong? You know, was there something in there objectionable or whatever? And then the phone call got set up, and I think I actually got the call at work during the day. So I found out while I was sort of in the middle of my normal, you know, day job that I had won. It was pretty surreal.
And your reaction?
I was standing in a doorway because there's not very good cell phone service inside of a brick and metal school. And I was just in the doorway on a conference call with Betsy and Sarah June and maybe one other person. And, you know, I about melted onto the sidewalk, I guess. When Betsy mentioned the Heart of Darkness line, that's when it really hit me. Like, okay, people have read this and thought about it and thought it was pretty good.
Very good book.
Yeah. Thank you.
A very good book. And it's always great when you've got a book that you like and you send it out in the world and the reviews are coming back as strong as they are. So that's really wonderful to us.
And well, let's talk about some of the reviews out of state. I think that's important, Betsy.
Yeah, it is. You know, the first thing you have to do is you have to go get blurbs for your book. And a lot of people who are publishing now come out of MFA programs. They've got lots of friends who are writers. They call up their friends to get blurbs. James doesn't know a lot of writers out in the world because he's a newbie at this. And so we went to some people that we thought this book was like. We went to Lauren Groff and Lydia Netzer and Rebecca Lee. And your readers may not be too familiar with them, but they all have New York Times reviewed books. And we sent them this thing with a plea that, you know, this is what Hub City is. This is what we do. Would you read this book? And they all came back and they loved the book. So then we have blurbs on the back of the book. And then we create a galley of the book. That happens in the fall. And I flew to New York and met with the editors at Publishers Weekly and Library Journal and Kirkus. and handed them the book across the desk. And all of them have come back loving this book. And those kind of reviews are very important for library sales. And we're seeing really strong library sales.
I was going to say, if you get positives there, that means a lot of schools across the country.
It does. And of all the books that Kirkus reviews in a given year, only 10% of them get stars. And beyond that, there's now something called the Kirkus Prize, where they go through all their stars and decide which books are going to compete for the Kirkus Prize. And we got notification that Minnow is one of the books that will be up for the $50,000 Kirkus Prize, which don't start spending that money yet, James. So anyway, that means that a tremendous review outfit like Kirkus thinks that Minnow is one of a small percentage of great books published in 2015.
And what about your fellow indie bookstores? I mean, I know there still are some around the country.
Yes, there are. We're working with Buford Bookstore, with Wilson McIntosh. We work with Fiction Addiction up in Greenville and Books on Broad. And I've been on the phone calling every little bookstore on the coast, making sure they know that this is a great beach read. It's set on the South Carolina coast and it's a great beach read. James is gradually hitting most of these. He'll be at the Edisto Bookstore. He'll be at Blue Bicycle in Charleston.
Litchfield
he's been to.
Going to Joe's Place in Greenville.
Yeah. So we're setting him up at every one of those.
Wonderful. And whether he's going there, I mean, you know, there is a network of Southern independent bookstores, and I assume that you've been doing PR to let them know what's going on.
We do. And SIBA is a very healthy organization, and because we're both a press and a bookstore at Hub City, we have great connections with these bookstores in South Carolina and beyond. I can call up an indie bookstore and say, we're an indie bookstore. We know what your life is like. We're also a press, and we have a book we think will sell at your store.
Okay. And James, at a book signing, tell us how people react. Or, I mean, do you do a reading? Do you just go there to sign? Or does it vary?
It varies. I've done a few bookstores now. I've been to the dark side, the big boys. I did a Barnes & Noble once. And then the other end of the spectrum, something like a Park Road Books in Charlotte. I did a signing there with John Seeley. It all really just depends on who comes out that day. If it's just a steady trickle, we may just be sitting there signing books as they sell and talking to people. And it's always nice to hear people who come in who maybe have heard a bit about the book or a bit about my family history. If we get enough people, we'll do a reading. You know, if we can corral them into a place and make them listen, we'll read to them.
We had a great event down here in Columbia. We worked with TAPS Art Space and Jasper, who co-sponsored the Columbia launch. He had a big crowd, and he did a great reading.
Well, speaking of reading, how about, James, doing a reading from your book for our listeners?
Absolutely. I think we've set the book up pretty well. As Betsy said, I'm going to read the storm scene where Minnow has gone up into a live oak tree. And in doing research about the storm of 1893, it's no fiction that people were tying themselves into trees to survive that terrible night. So Minnow is up in a live oak. His dog is slightly below him, sort of in the cleft of the trunk. And he's up there with a woman and a boy who he just happened to bump into, and he helped get them into the tree. They've got two lengths of rope, and that's sort of where we begin here. "I don't know if I can hold on," the woman yelled. They were almost within arm's reach on the two different branches, but the ripping gale carried her voice away. Minnow leaned in and squeezed his branch. He pressed his cheek against the cold, wet bark and closed his eyes. The branch was solid and thick, but its size made it hard to get his arms around. "Take this," he said, sitting back up and holding out one length of rope. "Put it around you and the branch." The woman leaned up and the boy cried as he was exposed to the open wind. She said something to him, leaned over, and took the rope from Minnow. That's when he heard the crash and the rushing. The dog began barking below them in the cleft. The rushing sound got louder, like a mountain river torn into rapids. The woman lashed the rope around her back and then swung one end around the tree. She did it the first try, and Minnow looked at his rope and wondered if he could do the same. But her rope wouldn't wrap around far enough to tie. She was stuck, leaned in with one hand on the loose end and the other end across her back. It wouldn't go around both of them and still tie at the ends. Minnow looked at his rope, same length. A gust caught him and he almost fell off. One skinnier limb was under him, twisting off like a spider's leg, and beneath that was the ground. Only the ground wasn't there anymore. The rushing sound came louder and he knew what had happened. The water had risen from the sea and flooded the world. He felt dizzy and looked back at the woman. She was looking at him already, and he knew what she knew. "Take mine," he yelled, holding out the second coil. "Tie yourselves together to the branch." He could see the bright smile through the night, the woman shaking her head. She dared to bring one hand to her face to wipe off a slick of rain. "No, boy." "Take it," Minnow said, holding it out farther. The woman drew in her rope and this time lashed it only around the boy, then around her limb. She tied it with 3 knots and then leaned in on top of him, hugging tight. The rushing sound grew louder, and now a crash came as the shed collapsed and broke in the torrents like thunder. "Best tie yourself and not let it go to waste. I'm sure you got a mama would want you to come back sometime, just like me and my baby." He thought of his mother, of his father, both still waiting back home, waiting in this very same storm. He looked across the gap at the dark woman. She was a shadow in the night, hugging her boy against the limb. Minnow lashed the rope around his waist, around the limb, and then knotted it. He squeezed the knot in both hands. The water had risen halfway up the trunk, a foot short of the cleft, and the dog. The dog whimpered and pressed itself against the tree. The water rushed and ripped and showed gray foam where debris swirled in its torrents. The whole island would have to be underwater. The hot summer wind did not feel so hot after he was soaked. The ragged gusts broke over his face and his body, forcing his eyes closed, blowing against every inch of his skin, eyelashes, hair. The randomness of the buffeting wind made it terrifying. Just when he thought he was used to the wind, it would rush in like a steaming train, howling and blowing, salty on his lips, tearing at his clothes and his hair. Then came another explosion of sound, a ripping noise, then a whistling sound as wind filled the little house, crashing and smashing as the contents broke and flew away, the walls' necks crunching and tearing, a final rocking boom as the entire thing collapsed into the flood. Nothing to see, blackness beyond, just the black bole of the tree, ragged and wild in the night wind. The woman screamed and her boy cried. The water flowed beneath them like a vast black river parted by the solid trunk. The wind came in full force, sustained, blasting the tree, bending even the stout limbs of the live oak. The weakest limbs snapped. The canopy's bole offered no shelter from the gusts, and now the rain strengthened. The stinging spray became a drenching downpour that flew at them sideways. Thunder clapped, and lightning flashed, and for just that second he could see every leaf and twig on the tree. The wind came swirling under the branches and carved waves that broke against the trunk. The wind hammered down. He squeezed himself against the branch. He pressed his face against the cold, wet limb. The dog howled. Minnow looked up along the length of his branch, then out into the darkness beyond. He looked back to his left at the branch next to him, and the woman was gone. The storm did not relent. The noise, the power, the cold rain. He squeezed his eyes shut again and felt hot tears behind the lids.
Very powerful.
Thank you.
Very powerful. And for folks who haven't lived through the terror of a hurricane, and, you know, there are a lot of folks. Hugo was a long time ago in South Carolina.
It was a generation. Yeah. How old were you, James?
I was a little boy, 5, 6 years old.
And, of course, Hugo didn't really do much to the Beaufort area.
No, it didn't.
Mm-mm. I had a former student he was at the medical university, and his friends decided to ride out the storm in his grandfather's house on Isle of Palms, and they ended up they tied themselves to the roof, but they literally had all their clothes, ripped their clothing off, and it's an experience they said they would obviously never do again. And I can remember just saying, you know, I thought you were a pretty smart boy. But it was one of those houses that had been built by somebody who, it was supposed to be hurricane proof, and the house did survive, but with the flood, with the tide, they had to go to the roof.
Yeah.
And they tied themselves to the roof.
Wow.
But thank goodness they lived to tell the tale.
Right.
But the stories of the 1893 storm, there were storms in the 1890s up around Georgetown. The same kind of thing is with the flat coast and the huge tides coming in. We really do not know how many thousands of folks died in the 1890s in the storms, particularly the 1893 storm. Mm.
Right, and like you say, it wasn't even the wind, you know, it wasn't the rain, it was just that storm surge that mm-hmm. just put everything underwater.
Let's hope that South Carolinians don't experience that anytime soon.
That's right. There are a lot of structures out there on those little islands now.
Well, you live in Spartanburg.
I do. I remember Hugo coming through, though. It was a big deal, even in Spartanburg.
Well, it was an even bigger deal in Charlotte.
In Charlotte, mm-hmm. yeah.
So, anyway, Alfred's giving me the wind-up signal. Any last words I'm going to go with you first, James, that you have for our listeners?
Thanks for having me on, and I hope that people will enjoy the book.
Okay. And Betsy?
And we hope they enjoy Minnow, and then we've got many books in the pipeline. This fall, we've got a book called Carolina Writers at Home, writers from North and South Carolina writing about their houses. So we have Clyde Edgerton and Nikki Finney, Alan Gerganus and Brett Lott, Joe Humphreys, 25 writers across the Southeast with beautiful photographs of their homes. So we're busy working on that one at the same time we're marketing Minnow.
And we will have a link from our journal website. All right, Betsy Teeter from Hub City and James McTeer II, the winner of the first novel award. Thanks for being with us today on The Journal.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much.
This is Walter Edgar, and I hope you enjoyed today's journal. The 20-year story of Hub City Press is quite a fascinating one, and the impact it's had not just on that community of Spartanburg, but also on publishing and writers throughout the Southeast. And to have a young writer like James E. McTeer win the lottery on his first major book, really pretty heartwarming story. This is Walter Edgar. Join me next week for more of The Journal.
Walter Edgar's Journal is a production of South Carolina Public Radio. The producer and engineer is Alfred Turner. Production of this program is made possible in part by listener contributions to the ETV Endowment of South Carolina.
The views and opinions expressed on Walter Edgar's Journal are not necessarily those of South Carolina Public Radio.